Hello everyone, this is Dave Levinsky from Growth Inc., and today I'm very excited to be able to interview Louis Crozier. Louis is the managing principal at Windward Investment Management. Now, Windward is an SEC-registered investment advisory firm serving high net worth individuals, trusts, retirement plans, foundations, and endowments. Prior to Windward, Louis worked in the private wealth management group at Goldman Sachs and at Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Louis has a bachelor's degree from Dartmouth, a master's of education from Harvard, and an MBA from the Amos Tuck School at Dartmouth. And finally, Louis is an author, editor of several books, including Selling Your Business, The Transition from Entrepreneur to Investor. And it is this topic, selling your business, that I'm really excited to talk with Louis about today. So to begin, Louis, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Dave. Happy to do it.
Excellent. Thank you. So let's start at the very beginning. You know, what should entrepreneurs do at the beginning when structuring their business to better prepare themselves for an eventual sale?
Well, I would say that many entrepreneurs are focused on the business and not on the structure of the business and on their personal assets and personal planning. And
okay.
While on one hand, that's exactly what they need to be focused on, because if they're going to create value, they should be spending most of their time on the business. I think taking a few steps up front, which is talking with qualified attorneys about the structure of the business, meaning an S corporation or a C corporation or an LLC. So the kind of structure matters with regard to what their ultimate intent of the business is, whether it's a sale or going public, and whether they have or may have offspring or others to whom they want to either gift or ultimately transfer ownership interest for the benefit of moving wealth down generations or moving wealth either tax-free or at a reduced tax. The structure of the business up front can impact the ultimate tax rates that they pay upon selling or upon some kind of business transition. And so spending a little bit of money up front to structure the business correctly will save potentially millions and millions of dollars later on. So that would be from a business structural standpoint. From a personal wealth standpoint, there are different trust structures that can be put in place, again, to take advantage of the fact that at the early stages, the business really isn't worth very much. And so shares of the business can be put into these structures early on at a very low or discounted valuation, and then gifted to whether it's family members or other folks to whom they wish to transfer wealth, again, outside of the gift tax system and at low valuations. So while it's not at the forefront of every entrepreneur's mind to do this stuff up front, I think getting some basic legal advice, because it really is basic. It's not, it shouldn't be enormously expensive, and it shouldn't be cumbersome because it's not particularly customized.
Right.
So spending an hour or 2 hours of time with a good corporate lawyer and a trust and estate lawyer is probably well worth at least the education experience and process.
Okay, now what do we do if I'm the entrepreneur and oops, I forgot to do this properly and I'm 2 years into it? How much flexibility is there to change my structure from, let's call it, you know, an S corp to a C corp, or change things in terms of gifting stock or stock options later?
There's quite a bit of flexibility, but the earlier things happen, the better. And so if you think of a menu that has 20 alternatives in the very first few months, it may have 15 alternatives 6 months later, and then 10 alternatives a year later, and 5 alternatives 2 years later. So the degree to which you can take advantage of structural and discounting issues diminishes over time. But I wouldn't say it's never too late, because there are still creative things that one can do later on in the process. And still worth, again, an hour or 2 hours of legal time from somebody who really knows what they're talking about.
Got it. Excellent. Now, at the moment you decide, okay, you know, I want to sell my business. I've been running my business for X amount of years, and I got the mindset, okay, I've had enough, or I'm ready to cash out. How long do you think that you should have in mind for the sale? Do you think you should start thinking that way a year before, 2 years before, 4 or 6 months before? You know, talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I would say a couple of things. If it's possible to do it, you want to start thinking about the ultimate exit at the point where you're forming the business.
Okay.
So it's difficult to do that, and you want to allow as much flexibility as possible, recognizing that the business can take multiple forms. It may need to take on new partners. It will change shape over time, but again, the earlier that you can do that kind of thinking, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get a business up and running and you begin to think, you know, I think that I want to transition out of this business and now is the right time, I would certainly, there are so many different factors, some of which are industry specific, so there's no blanket answer to that, but I would say a good year or so in advance probably makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then the process would involve what in most cases is really common sense, talking with trusted advisors, people who understand the industry, and perhaps not showing your hand completely, because you don't want people to know your business is necessarily in play.
Mm-hmm.
It's often not attractive to customers to know that you are trying to cash out. But to the degree that you can get good intelligence about the general environment, the general business environment, but industry-specific environment with regard to valuation, with regard to the kinds of acquirers that may be out there, whether those are financial buyers or strategic buyers, meaning companies that might pay more than fair value for strategic reasons, getting a lay of the landscape so that you, and frankly, the entrepreneur is going to, in many respects, know better than somebody who might help structure a sale. They will know their own industry better. They may not know the financial metrics of the current time period as well as some folks who are actually structuring these deals.
Now, who are these? You know, you talked about the trusted advisors, and earlier you talked about like a corporate lawyer and a trust and estate person. Who is your advisory team? Who should make up your advisory team?
Sure. So somebody with both personal and corporate accounting experience.
Mm-hmm.
Again, trust and estate lawyer, which most of the large firms have, and then there are more boutique firms. And as you get into smaller firms, often prices are lower.
Mm-hmm.
So accounting, tax, the trust and estate side. To a certain degree, you might put in place some folks on the insurance side, whether it's both business insurance as well as personal insurance. And I'm a little hesitant on financial planning and advice, because often at the outset, when you don't have many assets, you may not have access to the kind of financial advisors that you will ultimately want to, with whom you'll ultimately want to work. So at the outset, if you can work on the corporate lawyer, the trust and estate lawyer, and somebody on the both business and personal tax side, I think that's a pretty good initial team to have in place.
Okay, so when you're saying the initial team, this is before the actual, you're ready to sell? You're saying this is more at the beginning of the organization or a year before the sale or at the sale?
Well, I think actually at the beginning of the organization, and then certainly you'll be talking with these people within a year of a sale or as you get closer. So this is a team that on a certain level, every entrepreneur should have in place at the outset.
Mm-hmm.
And then as wealth begins to get created, as value in the business begins to get created, insurance could be put in place,
mm-hmm.
both personal insurance as well as additional professional and liability insurance. Because as you have assets, you become more attractive as a target for people
mm-hmm.
who may want to take away your assets.
Right.
So.
Okay, and then you mentioned like a financial advisor, I guess like an investment banker. You would want that investment banker closer to the sale time?
Yes. And when I talk about financial advisor, I'm referring primarily to someone who will provide you with personal financial advice.
Got it.
That's,
okay.
That's typically more after a transaction, more after real liquid wealth has been created. But
okay.
you're correct to refer to folks on the advisory side who can help you position the business. Once you have a business up and running and it's doing well, there are certainly things you can do in advance of a sale to help enhance the value and make sure that teams are in place, other internal business structures are in place to maximize the value prior to a sale. And certainly
mm-hmm.
if you're taking a company public, there are things you need to do on the financial, the balance sheet and income statement and just the financial statement side of things that you need to do in preparation for that.
Okay. Can you talk through a little bit more? You just start talking about enhancing the value of the sale. I think that's something that a lot of entrepreneurs need to understand a little more. Can you just go through a little more detail on what entrepreneurs can do once they decide, hey, I want to sell this company to enhance the value?
Sure. If you think about how a buyer might look at your business, they're going to think about where are the vulnerabilities of this business, i.e., is this business dependent on a small number of key customers? Are there key employees? What kind of barriers to entry or intellectual property are associated with this business? In other words, where is this business vulnerable to either competitors or major disruptions? So trying to
mm-hmm.
identify those in advance and shore those things up. An example would be if you have one or two key employees without whom the business loses tremendous amount of its value, you want
mm-hmm.
to either be beefing up that team of people or putting incentives in place to retain those people. Again, I think the most constructive way to begin to think about protecting the value of the business is to look from the outside at the business's vulnerabilities.
Got it. That's a great point. I like that a lot. How do things change based on the sale of the company, the sale price? So prior to distinguishing between a good restaurant that's going to sell for $900,000 versus an emerging software company that may sell for $25 million. Do things change dramatically from those two examples?
Well, I would say industry-specific criteria come into play in the example that you just gave. I would say things that enhance the value of a business would be different kinds of either proprietary product or intellectual property,
mm-hmm.
Things that are hard to replicate, things that are actually protected by patents, trademarks, things along those lines. In the case of a restaurant, I suppose that has more to do with brand and positioning and location and the great chef and et cetera, whereas there's much more intellectual product in the in the software side of things. Go ahead, sorry.
Sure. So what about the sale process? Does the sales process of selling the business change dramatically in terms of the advisors that you need, in terms of the process of going through the sale in those two scenarios, the restaurant versus software company?
I think the answer is probably. And
okay.
I think I'm getting a little outside of where I can really give good
okay.
expertise on that one. But obviously turning to the trusted advisor who has very specific industry experience there in the
mm-hmm.
sales process is going to be where you'll get a better answer than.
Excellent. Okay, the next question I have for you is, what are the main types of selling deals, such as selling for all cash or selling for all stock, and how common are each of these deals?
Sure. So I would say that the deals that I've seen most commonly would be sales for all cash, sales for
okay.
stock, sales for a combination of cash and stock, and many deals will have earn-out provisions, which generally mean you will receive part of your payment for selling the business up front, and the rest
mm-hmm.
you'll receive based on milestones that you meet over, say, a 1 to 3 year period. And
okay.
Generally speaking, I would say that selling for cash is more attractive than selling for stock, although often
mm-hmm.
a stock sale will be tax deferred. So
okay.
to some degree that can be attractive, but I've seen numerous examples of people selling their business to companies that they think are very high quality, and frankly they are high quality companies, but
mm-hmm.
the stock that they receive looks very appealing but could fall in value by as much as 80-90%. Examples there would be technology companies and deals.
Mm-hmm.
I had experience with a couple of entrepreneurs who sold their businesses in the 1999-2000 timeframe. These were
mm-hmm.
technology businesses, and they sold them to very brand-name technology firms and proceeded to
mm-hmm.
lose between 70 and 100% in the case of a couple of folks
mm-hmm.
of the stock that they received. And so generally, I would encourage people to take cash, even if they are selling
right.
to a General Electric, which
right.
when you look at a stock like that, can rise and fall in price by as much as 50 or 60% over the course of a couple of years.
Louis, sorry about that. I think we got cut off, and you were talking about how you gave, even with the GE example, that you want, your preference is always to take all cash if possible. Is that correct?
Sure. So I would say that most entrepreneurs know their own businesses better than any possible acquirer's business.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I give the General Electric example is General Electric, in many respects, is many different companies, and about
mm-hmm.
50% a financial services company. So in the last few years, for example, the financial services piece became a very difficult part of owning that company's stock. So
mm-hmm.
in simple terms, I would say that if an entrepreneur is running his or her own business, they are likely to know most of the surprises that can come down the road, and if they decide they want to sell it and cash out, that's what they should do, is really cash out, as opposed to
mm-hmm.
Take on the risk of some other company that they know less well. Another way to gain liquidity is to go public, and
mm-hmm.
going public has its own set of concerns from a regulatory standpoint, but also from a personal scrutiny standpoint, because you will be subject to tremendous exposure, I would say, both personally and professionally, if things
mm-hmm.
don't go well. And so when companies are doing very well and they're public companies, it can be quite glamorous, and when they're doing poorly, it can be very, very invasive, both professionally and in particular personally. So I think there needs to be a real strategic reason for going public, and often the public markets will garner a bit of a premium in terms of valuation, but I'm not convinced that there's any reason to take your company public unless a public company is going to have strategic advantages in the marketplace. So if you're not going public and you aren't being purchased for cash, then you're being purchased for stock, and that can be okay, but I would encourage most entrepreneurs to at least set a certain amount of money aside that's going to be their nest egg in case the acquiring stock has acquiring company has trouble and their stock declines surprisingly, so that all that you've worked for does not trickle away because of somebody else's business mistakes that are out of your control. In terms of the earnouts, often earnouts are structured in such a way that milestones are hard to meet. I would say I do hear more stories of earnouts not coming through quite as well as planned, and so to the degree that one can, again, get as much cash up front or set aside or sell relatively quickly the stock from an acquirer, at least to put in place a nest egg, I think those are the entrepreneurs who feel most satisfied with their transaction, you know, in very broad generalization terms. But it's a real shame if you've worked hard and then you see your wealth dwindle due to forces that are outside of your control.
Definitely, definitely. Excellent. So I want to switch gears now and talk about once the entrepreneur sells their company, and ideally they're sitting on a lot of cash, and what do they do now in terms of reinvesting their earnings? I think a lot of entrepreneurs, they dream for that moment, but they don't really think about, okay, now they have this money, what should they do with it? So can you start talking about how should you reinvest your earnings?
Sure. So hopefully early on the entrepreneur did put in place the kinds of structures or entities to hold the company stock so that once there is some liquidity at the outset, it's already in the right structures so that from a tax perspective it can get to the ultimate places more smoothly, less expensively. And if that's done, I think that one large piece of the puzzle has already been achieved. In terms of investing, many people who did not have enormous amounts of money prior to a sale, or at least the value of the company was illiquid, I think face an emotional experience that they didn't really anticipate.
Okay.
And this means they will become more popular, receive many inquiries by folks who are very eager to provide them with advice, because usually these transactions are fairly public in nature.
Right.
And often the folks who are trying to provide the advice only get paid once money gets invested. And so they have an incentive to get the entrepreneur to act very rapidly. And
right.
So one thing that I hear repeatedly from entrepreneurs is, I wish I had waited following my transaction and not reinvested the proceeds as quickly as I did, because I wasn't ready to see the value of my investments move around or fluctuate as much as they did. So, for example, if somebody was living on $100,000 to $250,000 of salary as they were growing
right.
their business, and then ended with $10 to $50 million in proceeds after a sale,
mm-hmm.
and invested that money, even in a relatively low volatility strategy overall, they might see the value of their assets fluctuate on a daily basis by $1 million to $5 million, not on a daily basis, but in other words, hundreds of thousands of dollars on a daily basis and potentially millions on a monthly or multi-monthly basis, and just not be ready emotionally for that to happen. And so I would encourage entrepreneurs to live with their money, perhaps even for as much as a year, in very safe, very liquid investments, whether those are U.S. treasuries or very safe money market treasury-like instruments, or in some cases, very short-term municipal bonds, not the auction rate securities that we've heard so much about, but very short-term municipal bonds that are in AAA-rated general obligation bonds that are backed by the taxing authority of whatever state they're in, so that the value of their money is relatively constant and they get a feel for what is it like to live with much more wealth than I had before. Obviously, some entrepreneurs are serial entrepreneurs or others were brought up with more money, but I would say in general, it is a life-altering experience to go from living comfortably but not elaborately to having a giant chunk of money fall into your lap. So once you have set aside enough money for taxes in very, very safe investments, meaning really treasuries dated out to whatever the tax due dates are, whether that's you know, for state taxes year-end and then for next April or the estimated taxes, but really laddered out in very, very safe investments, then you can begin to think about creating an investment portfolio. And the first thing I would encourage the entrepreneur to do is begin to put in place a family office-like structure. And that doesn't have to be a staff of people that they hire themselves. Often entrepreneurs will hire a multi-family office, meaning entrepreneurs will share staff, share the personal tax and accounting folks, share the investment folks who will vet managers and act as the buffer or intermediary so they're not receiving hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of phone calls from people who are eager to invest their money. And I would try to pick those advisors by making sure that their incentives are aligned very closely with your own, which means they should be paid a reasonable fee for their time and their ideas and their expertise, but they should probably not be paid a fee based on whether or not you do something, i.e., if somebody is only paid a fee to if you invest in their product or in a certain product, that's going to taint the advice that they give you. And in many respects, the brokerage industry is set up in just that way, where not only are the brokers not paid if you don't transact, if you don't actually invest, but they are paid differently depending on what they get you to invest in.
Right.
An example would be a broker probably gets paid relatively little for cash, if you just hold cash, around the same thing, or maybe even a little less if you invest in bonds. And then typically they will get paid more if you invest in stocks and more if you invest in hedge funds. So as your investments get more esoteric and often more risky, the broker will get paid more. So it's this kind of relationship that either you should avoid, or at least it needs to be very, very transparent to you so that you can be sure that the incentives of your advisors are correctly aligned with your own. And then I would say my preferred entity would be a multifamily office as opposed to working with a brokerage firm or even directly with a single investment advisory firm. So what the multifamily office will do for you is not only coordinate your trust and estate issues and your tax issues and your insurance issues and educating multiple generations in terms of living with wealth, et cetera, but they will also help you pick and evaluate managers and structure an overall investment strategy with which you're going to be comfortable. And in very simple terms, I would say that at a bare minimum, most entrepreneurs, at least in hindsight, will say that they were happiest when they set aside a good, solid amount of money as a nest egg and invested that money in really quite stable assets. And often that means bonds, but it also can mean a very well-diversified multi-asset portfolio, which has a risk profile that's really very stable. And then once you've set aside $10 million or $20 million or $30 million or whatever you think will provide you with any income you might need for many, 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 many years, in other words, your life, in case you don't create another business, then you can start to designate more risk capital if that's of interest at all. It may not be of interest. But I think, generally speaking, those folks who've made very large sums of money do get the idea that they're shifting from growth mode to preservation and maintenance mode. And sometimes those folks who've made just a small fortune might feel like they need to reach a little more. And that's that's where I've seen more of the mistakes happen, where entrepreneurs will receive, let's say, $3 to $7 million after tax for a transaction, and they feel like that's not quite enough to sustain this lifestyle that I had anticipated, so I think I'm going to put this money more at risk. And, you know, on the one hand, yes, it makes sense to try to grow those assets. But on the other, if they're not used to having this much money and it starts to go down or move around in value on a daily basis with a magnitude that they're not comfortable with, they will often get out of those investments at the very worst time. And usually that means once they've declined. So that's tricky.
Excellent. I think what you're saying just makes perfect sense. I mean, I like what I'm hearing. You know, the goal of, you know, getting that amount that you want to set aside for the rest of your life and getting into preservation mode. I can definitely see a lot of entrepreneurs making mistakes that you're talking about, you know, investing too quickly, too much, and too risky. And it's got to be a major shock when the money starts fluctuating in a negative way. Excellent. So,
let me just add one thing, because in this world of repeated and very clear fraud that's happened in the last couple of years that's just been coming forward. It's not that fraud hasn't happened in the past, but there's been a renewed amount of very obvious and large-scale fraud, that it is important for entrepreneurs to distinguish between the entity or people that are managing the money versus the entity that is holding the assets, that has your assets in custody. And so for custodial purposes, I would suggest that entrepreneurs use one or more large, well-known custodians.
Okay.
And it's a little bit difficult to evaluate the soundness of these large financial institutions.
Right.
But in terms of fraud risk, you want to be sure that they're very large, recognizable institutions holding your assets. And then the people making the investment decisions can have the power to invest and reinvest, but not the power to withdraw funds, not the power to move funds from account to account outside of your name. And if you do that, then the likelihood of theft is very low. There's certainly some risk, as we've seen in the last year, of the financial institution having trouble, and so perhaps spreading your assets between a couple of different large custodial banks is a good idea. But I just wanted to bring that, the distinction between who's managing your money versus where is it held, to the forefront.
Excellent. That's a great point. Lou, just two final questions. One sort of wrapping up each section that we talk about. Is there anything else in terms of starting with the reinvesting your earnings section? What else or anything that our listeners should know about reinvesting their earnings after selling their business that I might not have asked you or you might not have mentioned?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. One is, generally speaking, I think it's very hard to find truly unbiased, trusted advisors. And so that's an area where you should spend a lot of your time and money to try to figure that out. Two is, regardless of how much confidence you have in a particular investment or asset class or direction that the markets may go, you should try to resist the temptation to pile into any specific area, even if it really is all bonds, for example, because bonds can lose money as well as stocks, as well as other things, and to really try to diversify your holdings extremely broadly with a specific sort of risk target in mind, but even still very, very broad diversification. And I'm reluctant in many cases to suggest that entrepreneurs tie up their capital in illiquid structures. The last couple of years have shown why.
Right.
So, again, along the lines of setting up a nest egg, the nest egg should not only be conservatively invested and custodied at a very safe custodian, but also fully transparent, fully liquid, so that you have access to these funds immediately, not tied up in any kind of limited partnership, illiquid structures. And then finally, I would say spend your time and money on asset allocation, meaning picking the broad categories into which you're going to be putting your investments, and less time on the individual managers within those categories. Although there's a caveat there, as you move from cash and bonds to domestic stocks, to international stocks, to hedge funds and more esoteric things, the ability of the managers tends to widen. So a very good bond manager versus a very bad bond manager may not have that big a difference in performance versus a very good hedge fund manager compared to a very bad hedge fund manager. Maybe the difference between up several 100% and down 90%. So that's where you should also be focused in terms of your time and effort.
Excellent. And then one final question. What else should our listeners know about selling their businesses that I may not have asked you about or you'd like to share?
Well, I think it's very personal. And in every case, I think you should really think through what you're trying to achieve for yourself, for your family, both intellectually as well as from a balanced life perspective. So a multi-dimensional look or soul search into what are you trying to get out of, whether it's your business or getting rid of your business. What are the real objectives, not purely financially, but from mm-hmm. all different aspects, because many people will tug at you or try to tempt you with the decisions surrounding a sale, but you really want to be true to sort of why you started the business in the first place and what you want your life to be overall.
Excellent. Extremely helpful. I think, Louis, thank you so much for your time. Everyone, I've been speaking with Louis Crozier from Windward Investment Management. You could find on the web at windwardinv.com. And Louis, once again, thank you so much for your time. I think your information was just absolutely incredible and will be really, really helpful for those who listen.
Thank you, Dave. I enjoyed it.
Excellent.
Okay.